From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on November 8th, 2024, at South Carolina Public Radio Studios here in Columbia. And just a programming note, we will be observing Veterans Day on Monday, and we'll have a new podcast for you on Tuesday. On this episode of The Lead, we look at election 2024. That's right, we are post-election 2024, folks. How you feeling? We have a recap of the presidential, congressional, and statehouse races and give you an in-depth analysis from party leaders, politicos, and more. Like I just asked you, how you feeling, folks? The election's over. Now, we are looking toward the future.
Awesome.
Let us know.
Yeah.
Let us know about it. 803-563-7169. How you feeling now? You gearing up for the holidays? You're just focusing on the holidays now? That's our next obsession. Let us know. 803-563-7169. Election 2024 has come and gone, and former President Donald Trump has been elected the 47th President of the United States of America, defeating Vice President Kamala Harris in an extraordinary and divisive campaign. Tuesday was the culmination of a years-long, bruising presidential campaign that at one point featured two South Carolinians and was complete with twists and turns up until the end, with America finding out early Wednesday morning that former President Trump, who refused to accept defeat 4 years ago, was convicted on several felony charges and survived two assassination attempts this year, managed an incredible political comeback to become the 47th president of the United States. Trump addressed his supporters in Florida after flipping several key battleground states, and the Associated Press formally called the race for Trump after he won the state of Wisconsin later that morning.
We made history for a reason tonight, and the reason is going to be just that. We overcame obstacles that nobody thought possible, and it is now clear that we've achieved the most incredible political thing. Look what happened. Is this crazy? But it's a political victory that our country has never seen before, nothing like this. I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president. And to every citizen, I will fight for you, for your family, and your future. Every single day, I will be fighting for you, and with every breath in my body. I will not rest until we have delivered the strong, safe, and prosperous America that our children deserve and that you deserve. This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
Vice President Kamala Harris ran an unprecedented and breathless sprint of a campaign over the past 107 days since President Joe Biden stepped down from the race in late July, and support quickly coalesced around her. Yet she couldn't shake the vestiges of the administration when it came to the economy and immigration, voters' top issues. Despite attempts to bring in some disaffected Republican voters, Harris saw slippage in key minority groups and demographics, according to exit polls, as vast swaths of America, including Democratic strongholds, shifted to the right.
I will never give up the fight for a future where Americans can pursue their dreams, ambitions, and aspirations, where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own body and not have their government telling them what to do. We will never give up the fight to protect our schools and our streets from gun violence. And America, we will never give up the fight for our democracy, for the rule of law, for equal justice, and for the sacred idea that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld. And we will continue to wage this fight in the voting booth, in the courts, and in the public square. And we will also wage it in quieter ways, in how we live our lives, by treating one another with kindness and respect.
Further down the ballot were all 124 House and 46 Senate races. However, more than half of those were unopposed on Election Day due to how the Republican majority House and Senate drew those 2022 district maps. And on Tuesday, the Senate flipped four seats to gain a supermajority like the House. State Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick said the party didn't pick up all the state House seats they wanted, but they continue to grow their presence, especially in the PD region.
From the Low Country to the PD to the Midlands to the Upstate, South Carolina continues to realign its electoral politics with its traditional conservative philosophy by electing more and more Republicans to office up and down the ballot in South Carolina. We aggressively work not only to defend our incumbents, but also to expand the playing field to use what we knew would be a wave of support for President Trump to pick up as many other seats at every level as we could all around the state. The results speak for themselves. We held our supermajority in the state House and we added one seat to it. We picked up an additional four seats in the state Senate, giving Republicans a Senate supermajority for the first time in over 150 years, winning 34 out of 46 seats. And as I mentioned earlier about, you know, South Carolina's electoral politics more aligning with its traditional conservative philosophy, I mean that especially in areas like that. I think that's a perfect example of that. In the last, you know, three or four election cycles, we've seen little ink blots begin to appear, if you will, in the PD and now have expanded. You know, Darlington County is a perfect example. We flipped a clerk of court, a clerk of court switch parties. We've had a coroner switch parties in Darlington within the last year. And then last night, we win a sheriff's race. We win a solicitor's race that has part of Darlington County. And then, of course, the Senate race. Again, I go back to the point where when you make those kind of changes happen, and they're not sexy, it's not the kind of thing people focus on necessarily. But when you get those guys at the super local level begin to switch parties or run as Republicans, you have that many more people who will vote a straight ticket, and then it helps the rest of the ticket going up. These are people who've been conservatives all their life. It's just now getting to the point where they can win as a Republican in that area. So they begin to align their party preferences with their philosophy.
More than 2.5 million South Carolinians, just like you and me, voted in this election, including 1.5 million who voted early, whether in person or by absentee. This fueled a more than 76.5% voter participation rate, the highest rate since 2008. Let's see what happens in the midterms. Not that much. The state's 18-point margin for Trump was the strongest for a Republican presidential candidate here ever. And that drove those down-ballot races that the South Carolina Democratic Party said that they didn't have the resources to combat, according to state chairwoman Crystal Spain.
When it comes to the Senate, we knew that it was going to be a tall order to hang on to all the Senate seats that we needed to keep. And that's why we invested unprecedented resources and fostered an unprecedented cooperative effort between us, the Democratic Party, and the Senate caucuses, and with our local party organizations. And this collective effort is just a testament to the commitment that we all have to elect Democrats up and down the ballot. You know, I think that, like I said, you know, Trump ended up having a pretty strong tailwinds last night. And like I said, our races were targeted. So we were talking to the voters in the districts. We didn't have one big blanket message, especially in the Senate. You know, those messages were really research driven. I can't say that that was the case. I really feel like a lot of our races couldn't hold on just because of the tremendous turnout on the Trump, with the Trump being at the top of the ticket.
There were no surprises in our seven congressional district races. The third congressional district easily elected its first new Republican representative since 2010, with Sherry Biggs replacing retiring Congressman Jeff Duncan. Biggs won a seven-way June primary and a runoff by 1,100 votes. She cast her ballot early in Walhalla last week.
Well, I think we're very vulnerable, and I don't know that we have ever been in this predicament as seriously as it is right now with our border crisis and with the economy, as I previously mentioned. And I think there's a lot at stake here, so we have to make changes. And I'm very happy to see all the voters turn out. And I think on Tuesday, we'll see the change that people are demanding.
She becomes the second woman in the delegation. Others in the congressional delegation, like we said, held onto their seats as expected, maintaining the six Republicans and one Democrat that make up the delegation. First District Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who survived a June primary, defeated Democratic challenger Michael B. Moore by 16 points in the most expensive state congressional race this cycle. Winthrop Political Science Professor Scott Huffman said Tuesday night that while Mace has solidified a third term by a 16-point margin, thanks in part to the stronger Republican-drawn district, a map that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in May, well, she still has an ideologically changing and growing district, though she did see her greatest amount of support ever in this election.
When you are that outspoken, you make yourself a target for, you know, getting primaried by people who are unhappy with you. She makes enemies just as easily as she makes friends. She can be very controversial. So, you know, how popular she is today, that could fundamentally change by the time 2026 rolls around. That's a safe Republican district. It's going to remain a safe Republican district. But Nancy Mace, you know, and she wants to be a loose cannon, and she can be a loose cannon. You know, whether or not she maintains her strong base, that remains to be seen. But right now, she's got it. She's going to get double digits, low double digits, but double digit win. Whether or not she can hang on to that or talk herself out of, you know, any leadership position or anything in the House, we'll see.
For a closer look at the effect of this election on the state level, I spoke with friend of the pod, Mayon Schechter of South Carolina Public Radio, and communications consultant Rob Godfrey, who was Governor Nikki Haley's Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications and also worked on Governor Henry McMaster's campaigns. We all chatted on This Week in South Carolina. But here is Mayon drilling down on those statehouse flips by Republicans.
Yeah, I don't think anybody can argue that Republicans had a really good night, not just obviously in D.C., but down ballot, especially here in the South Carolina State House. And like you mentioned, Republicans were able to flip four seats in the state Senate held by Democratic incumbents, including three who had been there for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. You have State Senator Mike Fanning, and that's a race that is incredibly close.
Yeah.
Vernon Stevens in the Orangeburg area, that was redistricted. Gerald Malloy, you know, coming from a county that has shifted toward Trump. And then also Kevin Johnson, mm-hmm. coming from Clarendon County, a county that basically has flipped red. With those four flips, Republicans will now have a supermajority, which gives them the ability to, you know, sit down filibusters, mm-hmm. carry out their priorities. Both of you both know, obviously, that Republicans, despite the lack of a supermajority in the past several sessions, were still able to carry out the priorities that they wanted. But those are big pickups for the Republicans. And those shifts really happen. You have a combination of these rural areas are just trending more red. Mm-hmm. These are areas that voted for former President Donald Trump in 2020 and in 2024. Redistricting played a huge role, but so did, frankly, campaigning. Mm-hmm. You had incumbents who had been there for a while, were working off of a lot of name ID, even maybe some other down ballot help, and it just didn't work out for them in the end.
You know, I think that what we'll look back on is as this cycle and this year is kind of the final farewell, with the exception of a bright spot in Senator-elect Russell Ott. Mm-hmm. We'll look back on this as kind of a final farewell of the rural Democrat in South Carolina, a trend that's been happening since really Governor McMaster was the chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party. It continued under the leadership of Caton Dawson when he was chairman of the Republican Party. And you see this, and you've seen it more and more each election cycle. And a lot of times with senators, it's coincided with the fact that straight ticket voting at the top of the ticket for the president has gone a long ways to help them. This year, Donald Trump ran up a margin that I don't think anybody expected in this state. And I think that some of those Democratic senators who were incumbents were the victim of that, politically speaking. You know, I don't know that there'll be many rural Democrats that we'll see elected in this state going forward.
Yeah.
And in another race, in addition to Russell Ott's, is obviously the one to replace outgoing Senator Thomas McElveen Democrat Jeffrey Graham won that race. And so, yes, mm-hmm. those are those shining spots for Democrats, especially, like you mentioned, in those rural areas.
Yeah, so it could have been worse for Democrats that night.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so far they're hanging on to those races. And then even with Heather Bauer in the House and Spencer Wetmore in the House, too, those were some close races that Democrats held on to.
Yeah, I think the Republican Party thought that they were going to be able to flip more seats in the House. Back in 2020, they flipped two seats, which, ironically, those seats no longer exist because of redistricting, and those lawmakers are no longer in the House. In 2022, Republicans flipped even more seats in the midterms, and so they really did think that with the flips they had, especially in the Senate, that they would see that in the House, and they just didn't. They did pick up Joe Jefferson's seat. That's kind of that Dorchester, Berkeley area. But yes, you mentioned Heather Bauer. She represents one of the swingiest, if you will, parts of Richland County. Mm-hmm. I mean, that race was pretty much deadlocked. And she only won in 2022 by, I think, just a few votes over 200. She more than tripled that. Mm-hmm. She beat former Representative Kirkman Finley by over 1,000 votes. So yes, I would say that Democrats feel especially good about that race. Also, Representative Spencer Wetmore in the Charleston area. That was another district that Republicans in the last few weeks had thought that maybe they could also pick up. And while they were able to keep their incumbents in Charleston, which is still a little bit, I think, of a surprise for a lot of Democrats, Democrats were able to keep Spencer Wetmore in that place.
Yeah, to mention that Heather Bauer race, I think that she's an example of an incumbent who didn't take anything for granted. Mm-hmm. But also, when we're talking about, you know, these GOTV efforts, mm-hmm. You talk about a lot of door knocking. You talk about a lot of things that I think are becoming more and more antiquated. Door knocking may be the new rotary dial phone of the 21st century, and we're underestimating, even in rural areas, the impact that the changing media ecosystem and communications ecosystem, where people are getting so much of their information from their phones, from places like TikTok, from places like Instagram reels and stuff like that. So a lot of that national messaging that got people super, super engaged in the presidential election, I think also got people engaged in the election in places like Clarendon County, where Donald Trump ended up running up a much higher margin than he ever had before.
And it seems like we're talking about, you know, the quality of a candidate too versus some of these incumbents who maybe feel a bit more comfortable, then all of a sudden things are changing and then they have to get out there and really kind of hit the bushes and try and get people, and then they realize the bushes are full of the opposite party at the same time.
I think that's right. I think while I don't want to totally downplay the fact that messaging matters, that candidates matter, the fact is that Democrats in some ways, I think, underestimated in these rural areas the small C conservative cultural issues that voters care about, and also they underestimated perhaps some of the quality of life issues that that are being talked about all around the country. People want to be able to put food on their tables. People want to be able to do things, you know, as simple as when they get off work, go and buy a six-pack of beer or a case of beer and not have to pay twice as much as they did 4 or 8 years ago for mm-hmm. it.
Or buy liquor on Sundays. We'll see about that this session.
That's right.
But Mayan, I want to ask you about, when we talk about priorities, we're talking about legislation. What are we hearing now from the leaders in both the House and the Senate, now that the Senate's going to have, you know, if everything holds, 34 Republicans, and then over in the House, 88 Republicans? What are we hearing in terms of priorities and what they're going to do with those supermajorities now?
Mm-hmm. So both Republicans in the House and the Senate are still trying to hash out and figure out what exactly they want to do, especially with this brand new membership. There are a lot of new freshmen that they probably also need to figure out how they're going to include them in this process. But I think the number one issue that we're going to hear a lot about, and we already have, is what's known as the educational school or educational accountability scholarships. You know, private school vouchers are also called. What the state Supreme Court overturned. The legislative leaders were not too pleased with that, mm-hmm. and they've already committed to going back and looking to see how they can perhaps fix the bill, fix what they passed last time, so that this new state Supreme Court will accept it, similar to what they did with the abortion ban. Mm-hmm. So I think that's number one. The governor, of course, will unveil his legislative priorities in January, and sometimes that helps kind of dictate what we will see happening in the House and the Senate, especially because especially in the House, because the governor and the House typically have gotten along pretty well.
And Rob, you've seen that too. You've worked with former Governor Nikki Haley. Y'all had a little bit more of a, you know, a difficult relationship with the legislature. That's changed since Governor McMaster has taken over. How do you see the governor, especially in his now last 2 years before we start really ramping up for the 2026 gubernatorial race, how do you see McMaster working with the legislature more now with this supermajority in place?
Certainly. Well, as somebody who's worked for both Governor Haley and Governor McMaster on two of his campaigns, I think that there's obviously a much better working relationship on the front end for Governor McMaster, and he laid out yesterday some of the priorities in his post-election news conference that he's going to be continuing to work together with the General Assembly on. And those are priorities that he'll not only benefit from an increased Republican majority, you know, working on, but those are priorities that he sees many of as bipartisan. For example, school safety, putting school resource officers in every school, you know, funding for mental health, those types of priorities. He's going to count on Republicans and Democrats to work on those things. And I think that's a great thing in South Carolina and something that's unique for our state.
And just to add on to that, as both of you know, so much policy that gets passed is not in the form of individual bills. It's in the budget. And that is obviously an area where we've seen the governor and the House, where the budget starts, really work together, an area where, of course, Democrats and Republicans come together and work on that. But I do think, again, you know, regardless of that and regardless of the vouchers, we will probably see bills pop up. Thousands of bills get pre-filed every year. I'm sure we will see things that probably align more with this change in a more conservative legislature.
No question.
But then, Mayan, when we talk about, you know, this everything's sounding so good and perfect for the Republicans, they're still, you know, they still have to work together. When we're talking about supermajorities, they don't all agree on the same thing at the same time, especially we're in the House where there are different factions at play too. Where do you see that going? And what have you heard from lawmakers when it comes to trying to work together to get things through the State House?
Well, we've long heard Republican leaders in both chambers say they do not want to become Congress, especially this last iteration of Congress where it felt like nothing could get done in the U.S. House of Representatives. So far, I don't think we've necessarily seen some of that lock jamming of legislation getting stopped. The House Freedom Caucus, especially the new iteration of it, does feel very emboldened after these primary midterms, or excuse me, primary elections in June. They were able to flip a couple of seats of longtime Republican incumbents who were great allies of the speaker. And so they do feel emboldened that this is a legislative session that they'll be able to move some of the issues that they care about. And, you know, to their credit, they did help sort of push some issues to the forefront in the legislative session, although I don't know if Republican leaders would necessarily agree with that.
Different tacks, yes.
Right. I do think we're going to continue to see that style of infighting in the House. I don't think that is going to completely go away. And, you know, there are some other things that are going on in the background that could change that or help hurt that. Who knows? But I think, you know, especially when you talk to a lot of the conservative legislators in the House, the emphasis has always been on the Senate, right? Because the House passes a lot of bills in a legislative session, and then the Senate typically slows it down. They're the deliberative body, and that's what they like to do. And sometimes that's not a bad thing. But a lot of House conservatives feel like finally, maybe with these changes in the Senate membership, they can see some of the bills that they've been trying to push, you know, faster actually move through. So we'll see. I mean, there is a definitely there is a, I think, a much more conservative tilt that is occurring in the South Carolina Senate. We'll see if they go through the same kind of headaches that leadership in the House has gone through.
Yeah. That was me talking with Mayan Schechter and Rob Godfrey. Welcome to the wind down section, our little break from the news. We're glad you're here. A.T. Shire, producer of the Lead Podcast. You're here with me as well.
I'm here, yes.
Post-election 2024.
I can't tell you, for everyone listening, I don't care how you voted.
I don't care
if you're happy or you're sad. You should all feel the cosmic weight of the campaign being over, lifted off of your shoulders.
The ennui.
It's like the opposite. It's sort of the opposite of ennui, where I'm just so happy I don't have to hear about this anymore.
I just like saying ennui.
Ennui is a great word. E-N-N-U-I.
Ennui?
That's not how you spell words. Okay, come on.
Okay. It's like
that's not how you spell it.
I mean, I'm dreading the day when that's going to be on my Wordle.
What do you want me to say?
There's not enough.
The double letters are always the trickiest ones.
Wordle is too easy of a game. You heard it here first.
Whoa!
Anyway, Gavin.
I want to start seeing your scores every day, plus.
I get it every day.
Sure, but like, I mean, what's the average?
I get it every day.
I know.
I play two words that are unrelated just to use up letters.
Do you want to tell us?
It's like flick and stare. That's
ooh, yeah, stare's good.
Stare. Those are my two, and it just uses it up, and then you figure it out by the fourth one every time. Anyway, Gavin, speaking of
the sixth one.
Like unrelated to everything we just said, we're going to do two calls, okay? The election's over. The election's over, so of course we're going to talk about the important stuff. Yes, I am talking about espresso and
Sabrina Carpenter.
Chapel Roan. Thank you, Gavin. Okay, let's get to this first call.
Hey guys, this is Baby's Mama calling to check in. It's been a while. School year's been pretty busy so far. I am not even touching anything political with this because that's hopefully going to be moved on from soon. However, I wanted to talk about the song issues and music issues that AT was having last time. See, what I'm getting from this conversation about espresso is that he is not quite to the period of parenthood where you literally have to put earplugs in so that you can handle the continuous monotony of Baby Shark. Let's see. My son is currently into the All I Eat Is Pizza song. Anything from Bluey on repeat. See, this is the musical montage of the next 5 to 6 years at least for you, AT. So I'm just wishing you the best of luck with that. I, again, am pleading for you to come to North Augusta or Aiken to record so that we can come to that. Anyways, I hope that y'all have a good time this week, next week. Stay safe. Talk to you next time. Bye.
Thanks for calling Baby's Mama. Yes, those little earworms that we're talking about there.
See, I hear where you're coming from. I've heard about the obsessions with the baby sharks and the blueies of the world. But you see, like, I'm just not going to have that problem because my baby's built different, you know?
Yeah.
I'm simply not going to have that problem because my baby's so cool.
Feeding her SpongeBob, and there's no songs in SpongeBob for the most
part. F is for friends who do stuff together. U is for you and me, Gavin. N is for anywhere and anytime or all down here in the Great Crusade. Okay?
There we go.
MPFREFONG song. Okay, so there are songs. Okay, they sang in the Bubble Bowl.
It's just not like consistent.
It's not the same thing. Yeah. All right.
And you got to get her like old, like Rugrats. You got to get her like Simpsons. Like, we got to make this baby of yours a 90s millennial child.
Yes. I'm going to lock her. Like, what's that movie, Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser, where I'm going to lock her in a bunker. I'm going to play her only standard deaf Nickelodeon.
She will be the coolest kid.
She's going to be the coolest kid in the world.
She will not be able to relate to any of the children.
No, she's going
to
be
It'll be okay because the kids won't even be talking to each other, but they'll be on their pads or whatever's whatever's on their eyes.
The various
screen
sizes.
They'll be wearing glasses that they just. Yes. I am talking to you.
Well, hopefully she'll have a neural chip by then. But,
I hope so. I hope so.
So I can make sure she's listening to enough Alice in Chains.
I was watching Twitch the other day.
Uh huh. I hate that for you.
Mostly because I wanted to understand it. Because, like, you know, everyone's talking about different ways to meet people. Not mm-hmm. meet people, but different ways to, like, you know, get your message out there. I'm like, do we need to be on Twitch, the lead?
Sure.
Maybe. Who cares?
Is it easy?
But I think so. I think, it's voyeuristic.
Yes.
Because there's one channel where it's, like, IRL in real life.
Yes.
POV, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're just watching people, like, walk through a mall, work out, mm-hmm. do blah, 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 like, okay, whatever. But I think this generation seems to
care
about that.
I think that's our problem. We don't care.
But also, like, why would I care? Like, instead of, like,
that's our problem.
Watching people, I'm going to go actually be with people.
That's our problem.
And that's the generational divide here.
I think we grew up in a non-digital world. Like, we grew up in an analog world.
But how
world.
Is that even interesting, watching someone just do it? Like, it's not
know.
Even...
There's a draw to outside. Anyway, speaking of outside this conversation, we have another call. Are you
Twitch,
ready, Gavin?
Yeah.
Okay, let's Twitch this one in. Okay, here we go.
Hey, Kevin and AT. Just listened to your wind down about Sabrina Carpenter. This is driver instructor Daniel up in Lawrence. And wanted to throw my support behind AT checking out Chapel Roan. I have no shame in the fact that I absolutely love her music, even as a 42-year-old truck driver. It is very interesting music, and I think AT's complaints about the Sabrina Carpenter espresso will not fly at all. There's always something different and unique happening in each and every song on the Downfall the rise and fall of a Midwest princess. Specifically, Summon a Nominon has this great beat change with every verse. So I hope that we get to hear AT check that out. It'd be really great if we could hear another intern come in and explain all this to us. Really enjoy the show. Keep everything going. And thanks for the little brightness at the end of all the election coverage, because we definitely need it. Take care, guys.
Truck driver Daniel, thank you for calling. I personally love Chop Road.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Daniel, at every point that you were hitting, Gavin was going, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I actually found out about her last year from my good friend Kate, who knew about her. And I was like, whoa. And I was like, and then, of course, you know, all the wheels fell off.
I do love that she was booked. If you know anything about Columbia, you know,
God, I know
New Brooklyn Tavern.
I know.
And she was booked to play a 250-person thing. And in the time of the months leading up to that show, she got so big, she started playing arenas by the time she was supposed to play a 250. 50
and
person.
They moved her to the township, and
still not
I
big enough.
Did not buy tickets.
I just think that's funny.
The prices are just so ridiculous.
I know.
And I'm like,
I know.
And I knew I was gonna look back and be like, oh, I should have done it. But you know what? No, I'm not playing that game.
I gotta
America.
Say, even though I am outside the poposphere of music, I listen
to the void.
To
of the poposphere.
The void. But I listen to terrible heavy metal and weird music that all the concerts cost $25 to go
affordable
to.
Affordable concerts,
it's,
right there.
I can't tell you how nice it is to pay $25.
Maybe
go to
I need a change.
A 1,000-person venue that has 800 people in it.
Yeah.
You can gladly, as an old person, stand in the back with your arms crossed, nodding.
What do they
it's
want?
Best.
I don't have to fly to Europe to get a cheaper concert
isn't
ticket
that,
price.
Isn't that insane?
What does that say? You know, I know we talk about Taylor Swift. Everyone has their opinions, but I'm supportive of her. But at the same time, you got the $1 billion, girl. How about we lower the ticket prices and make this more affordable to everybody? Like that's what you should be doing in terms of like giving back.
I think the most expensive ticket I've ever bought, it was either to see Van Halen or Rage Against the Machine. Mm. One of those two. Which also the idea of Rage Against the Machine selling $100 hoodies and $250 tickets is like. It's cognitive dissonance.
Gen X is going
to
Gen X, am I right, guys?
Yeah. Get the call. Crazy. The crowd goes crazy.
From this millennial, I just love going after Gen X because they just...
They got nothing.
Talk about the silent generation.
They truly had 4 years in the 90s. Anyway, yeah. Gavin, let's go. Let's hit the outro.
That will spur some people up
hit
to call.
Hit the outro.
Come on, my Gen Xers. We love you. We love you. Just like Baby's Mama and Truck Driver Daniel, we have to do a show in Aiken and also do one in Truck Driver Daniel's truck. Beep, beep. Now you can leave us a message like they did at 803-563-7169. And of course, thank you for listening to the pod. You can show us your appreciation by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or a voicemail at 803-563-7169. And you can stay up to date with the latest news on scetv.org and southcarolinapublicradio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.
Did you hear that?
What?
Mr. Cool Hat.
Oh, you're Mr. Cool Hat? Yeah.
It's Mr. Cool Hat.
Putting on the Ritz. Gavin is actually allowed to smoke inside now.